Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Owning the Sun, a people's history of monopoly medicine from aspirin to COVID-19 vaccines, by Alexander Zaitchik, read by Johnny Heller. Inventions financed with public funds should inure to the benefit of the public and should not become a purely private monopoly under which public finance technology may be suppressed, used restrictively, or made the basis of an exaction from the public to serve private interests. Public control will assure free and equal availability of the inventions and will avoid undue concentration of economic power in the hands of a few large corporations. Scientific and technological research conducted or financed by the United States represents a vast national resource, rivaling in actual and potential value the public domain open to settlement in the last century. The soundest disposition of government-financed technology is, as a general rule, to open it freely to the public and spread the benefits of the scientific advances as widely as possible. Final report of the Attorney General to the President on Government Patent Practices and Policies, 1947. Introduction. In the beginning, there was alchemy, a fusion of metallurgy and magic. The alchemists probed nature in pursuit of the unnatural, of eternal life, and the power to make silver from lead and turn copper into gold. The alchemic grail, known as the Philosopher's Stone, was never found. But the foundations of modern chemistry and pharmacy were laid in those discoveries made in failure, and upon them grew an industry that over the last century finally achieved the elusive sorcery of turning base elements into precious gold. Consider this. Between 2000 and 2018, the 35 largest drug companies reported cumulative gross profits of almost $9 trillion. During that same period, the value of the world's total gold reserves crested at just over $7 trillion. The magic behind this feat has nothing to do with synthesizing common molecules into more valuable ones. The industry's Merlins aren't its scientists and technicians, but its patent lawyers and lobbyists. The products these companies sell have value, but not so much as to surpass all the gold that's ever been mined. The science, once released, can be copied, in most cases very easily. The kind of wealth amassed by the pharmaceutical industry can be created only by the political magic of monopoly. If the state ceases to grant, enforce, and extend exclusive rights to the production and sale of drugs and medicines, the power to spin private gold from public investment and human illness combusts and disappears, like the purified bone-dust phosphorus of alchemy legend. This is not a book about how to hasten the combustion of monopoly medicine or about the many fine alternatives that could take its place to humanity's benefit. It is the story of how monopoly medicine came to be, from the earliest debates over the morality and practical value of granting monopolies on life-saving inventions to the globalization of this right by Washington on a basis of forced consent. It is the long prequel to our current age of crowd-sourced online medical fundraisers, of hedge funds and Martin Shkreli getting a say in who lives and for how long, of the minting of biotech billionaires during a pandemic while vaccine factories sit idle, and of the lobbying, propaganda, and marketing machines that protect the system from the steaming volcano of a public that understands it to be fundamentally corrupt and unjust. The drug companies spend heavily on telling and retelling their version of this story. That's actually their in-house trade name for it, the drug story. According to the industry narrative, monopolies and the outsized profits they generate can alone incentivize and deliver innovation. The system is working just fine. Any interference will cost humanity dearly. The following account is told from the perspective of the dissenters, critics and antagonists who see this as a dishonest and dangerous fiction. These figures have shadowed and challenged the development of medical monopoly at every step, issuing democratic echoes of the English King Henry IV, who in 1404 decreed it a felony to multiply gold or silver or use the craft of multiplication by alchemic means. The act against multipliers wasn't about shutting down pagan rituals or taking a stand against supernatural criminality. It was a preemptive strike against private wealth becoming private power, strong enough to challenge the authority of the crown. Centuries later, the same fear inspired spirited Republican opposition to monopoly in the North American colonies. This hostility survived the founding and continues to make cyclical appearances of varying intensity. Since World War II, the pharmaceutical industry has provided a sitting target for the country's deep, if suppressed, democratic instinct to favor broad public interests over narrow private ones. Over the last 7 decades, the industry has become a target so fat and unmissable that taking a swing at it unblindfolded almost feels unfair. But its grotesque girth is the very thing that has allowed it to become so devilishly elusive. As Henry IV, Thomas Jefferson, and Louis Brandeis understood, if you allow the unnatural multiplication of private wealth, eventually its power will slip all social constraints. You will wake up one day to find Merlin wearing the crown. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's famous speech to the 1936 Democratic Convention was a warning against this scenario coming to pass. Though Roosevelt declared war against unnamed economic royalists, the New Dealers understood the real targets to be the invisible sources of their awesome power, the weak regulations, bad laws, and corrupted statutes that enabled monopolies to dominate the economy and threaten the country's experiment in self-government. Patents were a major concern of the late New Deal, but not drug patents specifically, not quite yet. In the 1930s, the pharmaceutical industry was in the final throes of a painful molting process. It was shedding the last vestiges of its own anti-monopoly tradition and assuming the mindset and characteristics of those new economic dynasties, thirsting for power, fingered in Roosevelt's speech. Anyone listening to that speech, from the worlds of academic research, drug manufacture, corner druggery, or organized medicine, must have heard echoes of the sulfurous anti-monopoly sermons that had filled the broad canopy of American medicine for as long as anybody could remember. The drug industry had mostly severed its connection to this tradition by the end of World War II, when the U.S. government began to nest the biggest bounty of scientific research the world had ever seen. The contest between public and private interests vying for guardianship of this science runs throughout this book. That storyline is charged by the inherent tension created by granting medical knowledge, or any knowledge, the same property status as a clarinet or a tractor. We've become dulled to the strangeness of it. But the concept of intellectual property remains profoundly counterintuitive, if not paradoxical. If you possess a milking cow, and your neighbor steals that cow, you have lost your cow. Consult any culture, east or west, ancient or modern, and some form of revenge or legal remedy would be prescribed. If, however, you discovered a process for making cow's milk healthier or safer to drink, and your neighbor imitated the method to make his cow's milk healthier or safer, the balance of opinion would swing against the judgment that a theft or any other punishable crime had occurred. This is because your neighbor's possession of your idea does not reduce your store of it. In fact, the opposite is true. Scientific knowledge, especially related to food and medicine, is a public good whose benefits, say, maximizing vaccine production at the lowest cost during a pandemic, increase the more broadly the knowledge is diffused. Economists call such goods non-rivalous. In Thomas Jefferson's formulation, he who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me. It is often observed that our current social and economic system imbues oppressive feelings of inevitability and permanence. A shrinking historical horizon doesn't help. If you believe something has always been some way, it is difficult to imagine changing it. This is apparent in the current debate over the waiving of intellectual property rules enforced by the World Trade Organization. Speak to someone born in 1980, and there's a good chance they think the WTO has always been there, a Taj Mahal of global trade. But they and everyone else born in 1980 were alive at a time when U.S. drug monopolies were not only widely condemned but also ignored, and the intellectual property regime imposed through the WTO was considered the twisted fantasy of a few Pfizer executives. If you were born in 1975, you inhabited a world where Switzerland, a pharmaceutical powerhouse, still did not issue drug patents. That changed in 1977. In Italy and Sweden in 1978. In Spain, not until 1992. Long before medicines entered the monopoly debate, many countries were hesitant to accept the general Anglo-American concept of owning ideas. A debate over the legitimacy and value of monopolies as awards for invention was a tempest across Europe throughout the 19th century and into the 20th. The Netherlands proudly maintained what it called a free trade in inventions until 1912. During this long argument, the fiercest denunciations of intellectual property were found not in left-wing journals, but in the pages of The Economist, whose editors advocated for the abolishment of the English patent system. The magazine asserted in 1850 that for inventors to establish a right of property in their inventions, they first would have to give up all the knowledge and assistance they have derived from the knowledge and inventions of others. That is impossible, and the impossibility shows that their minds and their inventions are, in fact, parts of the great mental whole of society, and that they have no right of property in their inventions. The free traders and liberals lost the argument. And in the early 20th century, patent monopolies were normalized across the industrialized world as a reward for every kind of invention and discovery, with one major exception. If people know one thing about the history of medical patents, it's that Jonas Salk's polio vaccine was nobody's monopoly. They know this because of a line Salk delivered on live network television on the day his vaccine was announced a success, one of the biggest news days of the 1950s. In five words, Salk took a nascent post-war debate over drug patents and stripped it down to its naked core with a rhetorical question for all time. Could you patent the sun? The details surrounding this famous quip are worth recalling. After the placement of all the scientific and technical knowledge associated with the vaccine into the public domain, the U.S. government signed manufacturing deals with several drug companies and put a hard cap on the price per dose at three times the cost of production. When the companies requested reimbursement for building out production infrastructure, the government said no. They were being paid to do a job, were turning a profit, and that was enough. When the nationwide vaccine field trial was declared a success, Dwight Eisenhower delivered a speech announcing that full details of its manufacture and the technique of injecting it would be given to every country that welcomed the knowledge, including the Soviet Union. Compare this to the Strangelovian comedy of corporate vaccine nationalism. Operation Warp Speed, the federal program announced in May 2020 to accelerate pandemic-related research, extended the $42 billion annual subsidy currently enjoyed by the industry. Let the companies maintain controlling patent rights without any corresponding obligation on pricing or technology transfer to the rest of the world, and treated the resulting vaccine monopolies as national security secrets in a medical-themed spy versus spy cartoon. The first and most effective COVID-19 vaccines are based on mRNA technology developed largely by the National Institutes of Health, NIH. Though the government owns and has stakes in many of the patents, it has assumed the now familiar role of obsequious junior partner to its commercial contractor, Moderna. When a group of House Democrats attempted in early March 2020 to legislate a few modest conditions on the first $8 billion tranche of coronavirus research subsidies, they were flung aside like so many Lilliputians by the pharmaceutical and biotech lobby machines. Pharma's man in Washington, Stephen Ubel, warned legislators that the industry would take its ball and go home if collaboration with the government, even in a limited way, results in a loss of intellectual property or the government setting the price. The pharmaceutical industry makes ultimatums like this all the time. Indeed, it is an industry built on threats. But in the context of the pandemic, it is easier to see the backwardness of the industry threatening the government that funds its work and protects its business model. In the private sector, it is standard policy for titles on inventions to revert to the company paying the bills. That the U.S. government does not enforce a similar arrangement on NIH-funded research is a hydra-headed betrayal explored in this book. The industry's defense, now decades worn, is that monopoly riches are the only possible incentive for scientific progress and medical innovation. That this is simply false is easily demonstrated with a cursory review of history and the breakthroughs routinely made by the world's public research sectors, including our own. Humanity was developing medicines long before the first company ran up the price of a drug because it could. Ever since cowpox put the vacca in the word vaccines, governments have demonstrated the possibility of contracting with the private sector from a position of self-respect and authority. Equally wrong is the industry's claim that curtailing its monopoly grip on public science would constitute an attack on free market principles. There is no free market in pharmaceuticals. The industry is based on a double protection racket of artificial monopolies granted and enforced by the state. This arrangement is frosted with a continuous public research subsidy that underwrites nearly all of the industry's products. When Donald Trump submitted a budget proposing cuts to the subsidy in 2018, the free marketeer drug companies howled in pained protest. The cuts were reversed. The industry's last refuge is a dark warning intended to frighten. Get anywhere near our monopolies, they say, and there will be nothing holding humanity back from a long sliding return to the days of the four humors, of leeching and cutting, of death by childbirth and common infection. Without the dangling enticements of monopoly to lure science forward, life will again become brutish and short, passed in pain, while subsisting on diets of pounded roots and herbs. This is rich, coming from the same companies that built money printers in the 1950s from a long run of patented antibiotics that they systematically mis- and overprescribed, hastening the current crisis of antibiotic resistance. When regulators curtailed the practice in the U.S. market, the companies moved the game to the developing world, where they pushed branded antibiotics with bogus indications, but showed little interest in researching so-called diseases of the poor. Tuberculosis, Chagas, dengue, dozens of others that affect a billion people in the global south. 20 years ago, the legitimacy of the system was challenged and shaken for its miserable response to the African AIDS crisis. It now faces another test over the right to make vaccines and medicines during the first pandemic of the 21st century. As I write this, in the summer of 2021, the G7 countries are on track to be fully vaccinated by the end of the year. Low-income countries are on pace to be fully vaccinated in 2078. And yet to hear the drug and biotech trade associations and their political allies tell it, it's meddling with the intellectual property regime known as trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, TRIPS, that constitutes, in the words of U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai, an extraordinary measure. In truth, there is nothing extraordinary about disregarding TRIPS, because there is nothing extraordinary about TRIPS. Its backstory is almost impossibly shallow and grubby. Its founding documents are younger than Justin Bieber. TRIPS is not the expression of a universal post-Cold War consensus in the way the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights gave voice to human aspirations after World War II. It was born as a brute and profoundly undemocratic expression of concentrated corporate power, the work of less than 50 individuals, according to a U.S. official present at the creation. One of that official's reluctant Indian counterparts, Prabhat Patnaik, has described the road to TRIPS as a parody of the wildest conspiracy theory. The negotiations that resulted in the globalization of U.S.-style medical monopoly were not so much held over a table as conducted on a rack. It was the only way to enforce a concept as peculiar and universally rejected as rent-seeking for medicines. This is the story of how one of history's worst ideas took root against centuries of tradition and came to dominate the world.